Stepping back now into the good old book of Job, how have y'all liked this book so far? It's deep, isn't it? My goal was to not make it depressing every Sunday as we went through it. And it's not always depressing, right? Because there's some deep, deep truths about God in and throughout this thing that we learn. Well, continuing on our look at it this week, we're going to be looking at the entirety of chapter 19. And before I get there, let me just kind of get your train of thought going. When it comes to things going wrong, you've all had some things that you go on in life and something happens, something goes wrong, right? And the first thing we begin to do is we immediately start to think of blaming somebody else. So if the car breaks down, what do? You blame the manufacturer. I can't believe they would do this and, you know, instill this in a car and blah, blah, blah. If your computer breaks down and freezes, you blame Satan, because that clearly is the author of that confusion for you. Or maybe you just got something like a coffee spill. And when you got something like that, well, maybe that was just on you, something that you did. Generally, what I've come to find is someone else, that we tend to blame somebody else for making us spill the coffee there. Well, our good friend Job has been through disaster after disaster, hasn't he? It's just one thing after another. And I think the big question that continues to hang in the air for this guy is, whose fault is this? Who has to answer for it? By whose agency did these things happen? Do we look at Satan and say it's him? Do we look at God and say, no, it's him? Do we look at chance, or the term we would use is luck, and just say it's that? Something along those lines. We've looked at several of his friends' responses, and Bildad was the last one to respond before chapter 18 comes around. And rather than help, this guy just took it, and he just made everything all so much worse. And he basically gave Job this very fiery description of the terrors that will come to those who will walk in sin and won't do that which is right. And then kind of looks at Job with a little wink, wink. You get my drift, Job. You understand where I'm going? And he's intimating, these things happen because you do wrong and because you've sinned. And Job has had a response for that. And it's one that has a little bit of self-pity, but within it too, we're going to find one of the most incredible Old Testament prophecies that affect you today. And it's all found in chapter 19. So beginning there, I'm going to just read through the first few verses with you. I'm going to start in verse 1. Then Job responded, "How long will you torment me and crush me with words?" And he's speaking to his friends. "These 10 times you have insulted me, and you're not ashamed to wrong me. Even if I have truly erred, my error lodges with me." In other words, guys, you are dabbling in something that is only between me and God. It is not your affair to interject your thoughts on this. Verse 5, "If indeed you vaunt yourselves against me and prove my disgrace to me, then know that God has wronged me and has closed his net around me." So his point, God and I both know I'm innocent. It's not that he's sinless, but he hasn't done anything and remained in an unrepentant state that would have brought on the difficulties that he has gone through so far. And the net that has collapsed around him, Job makes it clear, this isn't a net I constructed for somebody else and then I accidentally fell into. This isn't about me. I don't know why this is happening to me. And he's communicating, God has just hidden the path from me. I really don't know where I'm going and why I'm in where I am. I don't know where the destination is. It's kind of like following in a fog, or following a path, but you're in a fog, and you don't know if you're making progress or if you're just going around in circles. And he can't see his destination, and he can't see the next step that he's meant to take. And he doesn't know why. Now, when you go through pain, that's really what so many of us want to find out, why. And we figure if we can answer why, that's going to remove some of the fog for us. We can at least understand, okay, where is this going and what is God doing? It won't necessarily solve the problem that you're going through. But instead, if you know why, you feel like, well, at least maybe I can endure because I know the path. That there's some place where this is going to take me and it will be helpful, God glorifying, and I'll get it. And ultimately, I think what we really want is we want redemption. We want to be redeemed from this. I think this is why so often when you see someone who loses a loved one, maybe to cancer, and not too long after that, they quickly become involved in causes that will kind of help in cancer research and so forth. These are the types of things that we seek to do because we couldn't fix the problem. Maybe there's a way I can redeem it, something that we can do here. But we don't get the why. And so when that happens, what are we going to do with it? Job, he can't answer the why. And he begins looking at the who, and he feels something. He feels like God is personally against him. And in verses 7 through 12, what you find is he's gonna basically paint, I'll call them several poetic pictures with his language of what that pain looks like and how he is experiencing what he feels like is the personal hostility of God against him, metaphorically speaking. Verse 7, as he says, "Behold, I cry violence, but I get no answer. I shout for help, but there is no justice. He has walled up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has put darkness on my paths." Again, it's the same idea. His path isn't clear to him, and he wants answers from God, but instead, silence. Verse 9, "He has stripped my honor from me and removed the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone. And he has uprooted my hope like a tree." You know, you see the imagery there, just like a tree that's pulled up or dried up. There's nothing here for me. His health is gone. He says his status is gone. And frankly, a lot of his hope is starting to fade too. I don't understand why or where it's going and what you're doing, God. Verse 11, "He's also kindled his anger against me and considered me his enemy. His troops come together and build up their way against me and camp around my net." Boy, that verse 12, I mean, that to me is one of the most pitiable verses that you see here, because Job feels like God has declared war on me. And it's almost like he's equating in verse 12, God's even taken the entire U.S. Army and pulled them all together and done an encampment just around little old me. Everything is coming against me, and I don't understand why. What is going on here? And the worst part, again, is when he says, "Why, God? What? Help me!" Silence. Nothing. He desperately wants someone, anybody, to stand up for him and to say, "Let me talk about Job. When it comes to Job, he hasn't done anything wrong. Job is justified. All the accusations that have come against him are unfounded." But nobody does this. His friends don't. His family won't. Doesn't seem like God will either. And it's one thing, ladies and gentlemen, when you feel attacked, isn't it? You feel it. But it's another thing to feel attacked and to feel very much alone. You're all by yourself. It's so much worse. And that's what verses 13 through 22 begin to reveal. He feels the hostility of God because of his solitary confinement that he finds himself in from other people. Verse 13, he says, "He's removed my brothers far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have failed, and my intimate friends have forgotten me. And those who live in my house and my maids consider me a stranger. I'm a foreigner in their sight. And I call to my servant, but he doesn't answer. And I have to implore him with my mouth. My breath is offensive to my wife." There's marriage counseling material here somewhere. I'm just going to leave it at that for today. "And I'm loathsome to my own brothers. Even young children despise me. I rise up and they speak against me. And all my associates abhor me. And those I love have turned against me. And my bone clings to my skin and my flesh. And I have escaped only by the skin of my teeth." You know, when you've done something evil or wrong, the most harsh sentence that we can put against you is the death penalty, life for life. But the second most harsh sentence that we can put against you is solitary confinement. Now, some of you extroverts may go, "Oh, I don't know about that, Jack." No, You get alone too long, you go crazy. You do strange things, you think strange things. Solitary confinement really is a harsh punishment. Job says, I've been sentenced to solitary confinement. I don't even know why. What is all this about? And he lets us know, I'm getting the penalty, though I am innocent. And you feel, when you read this, you just feel how completely alone this guy is. You ever been there? Most of you have at some point. That place where you're just, nobody gets it. Nobody understands me. And this is the ancient world's version of being ghosted. You know, you send out your messages, you try to communicate with people. They don't even open the text or the email. It just sits out there in the digital realm, and no one even picks up, no one even considers it. It's in this text we get that famous phrase, the skin of my teeth. Most of you have used that before, meaning Job has barely made it through to the point when it comes to his health, he's probably lost all of his teeth. They've fallen out. And now all there are is the skin of his gums that remains. And he cries out in verse 21, and don't miss the heart in this. Pity me. Pity me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does and are not satisfied with my flesh? And that's another one of the most pitiable verses that you find in Scripture. Will you look on me? Will you not isolate me? Won't you at least be my friend and help me? And that's Job's question of Bildad. My goodness, if this is what friendship is, what must enmity look like is what he's communicating. And in verse 23, we find Job's cry here. He says, oh, that my words were written, that they were inscribed in a book. Somewhat prophetic. He didn't even realize it at the time. Verse 24, that with an iron stylus and lead, they were engraved in the rock forever. Something that would be permanent to cry out as a testimony in his favor. And now I personally believe as Job is doing this, this is just conjecture on my part, so put an asterisk on this. But I can't help believe that Job thinks this is going to kill me. I'm not going to survive this. I will lose my life. And when he dies, what are people going to say? He's the only one that can proclaim his innocence. And now when he's gone, who's going to proclaim it? Nobody. And I think he's very concerned that you're going to find this on his tombstone. Here lies Job, destroyed by God, unrepentant in sin to the very end. And he longs for the truth to come out, but it's just not happening. And here is where things begin to change. He stops and he looks up into heaven. And I can't help but think that he sees something like some form of an avatar, somebody whose shape is foggy, whose face is blurred, somebody who apparently is timeless, somebody who is in heaven. And in verse 25, if you have your pen, you circle this one in red. You mark this one because this may be one of the most significant passages you'll find in all of your Old Testament, in which Job, I think, unknowingly made a declaration that's one of the most important aspects to our faith. He says in verse 25, as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last, he will take his stand on the earth. Now, I want to break that down with you briefly for a little bit. He says, my Redeemer lives. The word for redeemer, it's one we don't normally use, is called goel. And it indicates someone who's, the term we use now is called a kinsman redeemer. Somebody that is related to you and cares for you and will seek to take up your cause and whatever it is that you have. Now, we don't relate to it as much today because generally we don't have what I'll call frontier justice. When something happens to us, we have the ability to go to the courts. And we do so in our county, we can go through it in the state, we can even go through this at the national level. They didn't necessarily have that in these days. And so when something bad happened to you, you needed that one who was going to stand up and be your advocate to say, no, I'm going to take care of this one. And they would seek to rescue you, or maybe they would just be a means of protection for you, or try to vindicate you when life went off the rails. Now, one of the best pictures we have of this comes from the Old Testament in the book of Ruth. Many of you may be familiar with that story. Ruth is a Moabite. She's not even a Jew. She marries a Jew. Her husband dies, and now she's a widow in a Jewish culture with her mother-in-law. And that just kind of puts her way out here on the periphery of society. She's kind of the lowest of the low. And God takes someone related to her through her husband, a guy named Boaz. And Boaz comes along, and he is referred to as her Goel, her kinsman redeemer. And what he does is he takes note of her, and he realizes that if he marries her, he can love her, he can vindicate her, he can provide her children, he can give her everything, her food, her sustenance, her care, all the things that she needs. He can do that and provide that in her life. And that's exactly what he does. Now, if you know the story, he actually has to go to somebody else who is a closer kinsman redeemer. And when that person declines, he steps up into the breach. And it's a beautiful picture of someone who comes along, someone else in their great need, and is their Goel, their kinsman redeemer. But that's not the only place in your Old Testament. Do you realize that Goel is a term that's used of God himself with Israel? When God told Moses, I want you to go to Pharaoh in Egypt, he said this to Moses, say therefore to the sons of Israel, I am the Lord, and will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from their bondage. I will also, and there's your word, Goel, redeem you with an outstretched arm and with judgments. God would be her kinsman redeemer and be the one to rescue them from the injustices that they were going through in their slavery. Now, that's another aspect of what the Goel would do. They would seek to avenge injustices. This would be the individual who would be the family defender. Some of you, when you read your Old Testament, you remember reading about when Israel got the land and they're all given these Levitical cities. And why do you have the Levitical cities? Because if you were to accidentally kill someone, you know, you're hacking away on a log, the axe head flies off, hits your neighbor in the head, kills him. The Goel is coming after you. They're going to avenge this. And so God said, I'm making the provision that you can go to the Levitical city, you get there, and now this is going to actually be a setup such that we can actually have a trial, a court, and determine whether or not you really are innocent or whether you're guilty. But the reason you had to do that was all because of the Goel going out to right that which is wrong, to take an injustice and make it just. Probably the closest thing I can relate to in this is go back in Western history, go back about the 1800s, you got a horse. Somebody steals your horse, you can't do anything about it, but the kinsman redeemer, the Goel, comes along and says, no, we're getting a posse, and we're going to get on our horses, we're going to go out, and we're going to find that horse thief, and then you do, and then we're going to hang him. And then after we hung him, we're going to get that horse, and we're going to bring it back, and bring it back into your home. Now, when you see Goel, the kinsman redeemer, the redeemer, in that light, I think it changes a little bit of how we interpret verse 25, to say there is a redeemer. There is a Goel that has seen everything that Job has gone through. And he's not gone through it at God's hand. It's Satan's hand. And it's the strange thing that Satan ultimately resides within the hand of God. But God does not do the evil. It is Satan himself who does that. And God himself had that one who was going to stand and say to everyone, you know, the one guy that you all have been accusing and saying he's the one at fault, he's not done so. And he's going to stand before all of you. And I'm going to be the one to justify it. And I myself will vindicate this man. Whoa. Over time, all are going to eventually see God won't let this man down. So that even if Job's tombstone did accuse him, and you know, tombstones and their markings on them, they tend to last a very long time. Even if he were to die and that accusation would go out against him, the eternal righteous Goel would eventually stand for him and make the proclamation either in this life or in the next to declare to everyone, Job did nothing. The suffering he has endured was not because of any sin he has done. And ultimately, Job is going to find vindication. The scales of justice will be balanced and everyone will look and go, aha, I see, I get it. And that's what verses 26 and 27 explain. When Job keeps the long view when it comes to vindication. Verse 26, even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes will see and not another. My heart faints within me. Ladies and gentlemen, that's resurrection talk. That's what that is right there. A new flesh that comes when this present one is torn and is destroyed. And he had a belief in the very thing he asked for all the way back in chapter 9, that umpire, the divine umpire, the one who could be our kinsman because he would be fully human, but also could put a hand on God because he'd be fully God. And in doing so, be able to reconcile and bring them together. And this would enable Job to eventually see God face to face and be vindicated. Now, Job did not know the full story of Jesus. But I'll tell you what, I can't help but think, but he's staring at the outline of him in and through this text right here. And that's the one Job is ultimately going to hold on to. So much so that he says to his accusers in 28, if you say, how shall we persecute him? And what pretext for a case against him can we find? And you be afraid of the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, so that you may know there is judgment. He's saying, my Goel will stand for me before heaven, and he'll stand before you. You had better be careful about the accusations that you present about me. Now, last week, we looked a little bit more in terms of Job and just sort of his emotional vacillations as he's gone on. And even though this is sort of a high point for him in his moment of faith, does he still struggle? You better believe he does. And his faith kind of bounces back and forth with a little time. But he would hold true to this ultimately. Now, why look at this chapter as a whole? I think that this chapter presents a truth. It's a very short preview of what the Bible will explain much more fully later on. Because Job is speaking here of way more than he actually realized. You see, we too are like Job. And at the same time, we're different from him. Because we're like Job in this. We've been beaten and mistreated and enslaved, held captive, and destroyed spiritually by a very harsh master. His name is sin and death. And that's what he has done to us. And if Satan could cause circumstances that would crush Job, his tactics on us, they're just going to be a little bit different. Because with Job, he's saying, I didn't bring this. This didn't happen to me because of a specific sin. But what Satan could do with us is he could look before God, and all he has to do is point and say, God, all I ask you to do is look at this individual and look at him in light of your holiness. And now you tell me, where do you need to judge against these people? I call you to account. Your justice has to prevail over sin. And knowing that, these belong to me in hell. And we do. However, there is a Goel, one who is fully God and fully man. Fully man in that he can be a kinsman to us and understand us. And while he lived under the regime of a fallen world and a sin-filled world, he himself never did sin. And because of that, he remained innocent. And what our Goel did was he then could say, their punishment, you can put it on me because I don't have any sin that I have to pay for. Give me their sin, and I will pay that penalty upon a cross. And in so doing, what does he do? He redeems. He buys back. That's the work of a Goel. He buys us back. And his resurrection from the dead shows us that God looked at him and said, that death is different. He wasn't paying for his own sins. The resurrection means he overcame the wages of sin, which is death. And that means God accepted his payment on our behalf. And then he did something. He gave us his righteousness. And in so doing, he's clothed us in his regalia of perfection. Again, another beautiful picture of this comes in your Old Testament. It's in the book of Zechariah. And there's a high priest, his name's Joshua, and he stands before God, and he's in these filthy clothes. And here's God, pure, perfect, and holy. And God looks and says, you can't come to me like that. Here's what we're going to do, Joshua. And he commands his people, you get those dirty clothes off of him. Get those rags off of him. And then he says, now bring out my best clothes. And now we're going to clothe him in that. And in so doing, you find that this one is now justified by God and that he could do this. And our Goel has clothed us in the righteousness such that when God makes an accusation against us, here's probably the best illustration I could think of to do it. You've got man, humanity, and God sees us in the blackness of our sin. That's the only way he can see us. But what happens when one puts their trust in Jesus Christ? Now you find a Goel that has a perfection. And God looks at him and says, no, there is no sin in that one. He is clear and he is clean. And now what happens with us? We who are in Christ are completely consumed by him in his righteousness, such that when God looks at us, he sees the righteousness of Jesus. We stand pure, perfect, holy. No sin, no blemish of our own. And the kinsman redeemer, ladies and gentlemen, has set things right. That's what he's accomplished for us, which means that no matter what somebody might want to put on your tombstone, we got a redeemer who will say, no, this one is righteous, completely righteous, because I, the Goel, have personally given it to him and to her. And what Job saw in shadow, ladies and gentlemen, we experience in its substance and in its fullness in Jesus Christ. And Job, all he did was he got a little glimmer of hope. I liken it to he's in a dark cell and a key is dropped and he can't see it except there's just this tiny little ray of light that points to the key. And what's different for us is it's not just this tiny ray of light. It's like the brightness of the sun and all the LED lights you can conjure up come down and point to him to say, here is where that rescue is to be found. To know that God is free and does not have to condemn us who are in Jesus Christ. There is a complete deliverance. And as a result, he can give you and I the very thing that Job longed for, a declaration that shouts, that one is righteous. That one is perfect. And we will live in that righteousness forever and ever. That's the greatest news we could ever hope for that God gives to us. It is secure in him. And in him alone. C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Screwtape Letters. I know many of you have read it. It tells the story of these two demons that are working over on this human being. And you've got the elder one, which is Screwtape, and he's got this protege named Wormwood, and he's given all this counsel to Wormwood about how to make sure this person doesn't ultimately follow after Christ. How can we get him saved? How can we keep him from getting saved? And so as the book progresses, spoiler alert, the human dies, and he doesn't go to hell. And so now you've got Screwtape, the mentor, screaming at a rage at Wormwood and his failure. And in the rant, I want you to hear what he says, because C.S. Lewis had profound insight on this. The demon yells at the younger demon about the man they've now lost to heaven. One moment it seemed to be all our world. The heart cold with horrors. And the next moment, all this was gone. Gone like a bad dream. And then he says this, your man saw him. What is blinding and suffocating fire to you is now cool light to him. Is clarity itself and wears the form of a man. He saw him. That's the ultimate answer to Job's cry, ladies and gentlemen, and ours, that we too can look upon a cross and an empty grave to say, I will see him. Why? Because I know my Goel, my Redeemer, he lives.